another question for you, by the way, before we begin. There seems to be some kind of a big football game today. Do we have any Steeler fans? Packer fans? Okay, I think we're unified as a church. That's good. And if it's this cold in Dallas, it's as cold in Dallas as it's been recently, I think the Packers may actually get this just because of sheer coldness. Well, anyway, this morning we are continuing in our teaching series called Reasons to Believe Your Bible. This has been a good teaching series. We've learned a lot of good, solid, rational reasons that we can trust this book is what it claims to be, that it is actually the Word of God. And this morning we're getting into something called Scientific Reasons to Believe This Book. And let me just tell you right up front what we're doing. We're going to be entering directly into the creation versus evolution debate. Because you know that creation and evolution are completely different sides. The Bible says that we are special creations of God. We are not something that just happened by chance. But biologists will tell us that we are just a product of random evolution. We just happen to develop over time. And that's how we came about. And we're two diametrically opposed poles on those issues. So that's the question before us. Are we special creations of God, or are we just a result of chance? And God doesn't exist, and God wasn't involved in us at all. Just so you know, this is something that is taught in our kids in their high school biology textbooks. And this morning, we are going to be interacting directly with the high school biology textbooks as we go through this. I am not shying away from that at all. So that's something we're going to do. Also, to let you know, as we get ready to dive into this, that this is going to be a little different of a sermon. I'm not going to be actually spending much time in the Bible. And you're going, oh my goodness, the pastor is ditching the Bible. You've been around here for a while, you know, we immerse ourselves in Scripture. For this particular topic, I think you know what the Bible says. We've got the Genesis, the first three chapters, pretty clear. We've all familiar with that. But most of us don't know science on this issue. So we're going to spend time in science. And if you're new today, don't think we try and ditch the Bible at all. This is just a special sermon in this area. Let's go ahead, and I want to begin by reading some quotes from the July 29, 2002 article of U.S. News and World Report. They had a cover article on evolution, and the title of the article is called "The New Reality of Evolution, Where We Came From and Where We Are Going." And these are some direct quotes out of this article. It says, "By now, scientists say evolution is no longer just a theory, but it's an everyday phenomenon, a fundamental fact of biology as real as hunger and as unavoidable as death." It's a pretty strong quote. Another quote from the article. "Scientists have confirmed virtually all of Darwin's postulates." Another one. "I'm begging people to treat evolution as a science and not just tack it on as an explanation afterwards." And this is sort of the cherry on top of the whole argumentation line they're giving in this article. It says, "The evidence against evolution amounts to little more than, I can't imagine it." Is that true? Well, thank you for answering my rhetorical question, but that's good. Is it true that the evidence against evolution amounts to little more than, I just can't imagine it? If you read the article, you come away that if you don't believe in evolution, you are anti-scientific, you're ignoring the clear facts of history, and you're living in a fantasy world, because it's obviously evolution is an accepted fact of science, according to this article. I don't believe that's true. In fact, what they don't tell you is there is a whole body of scientific evidence that is intentionally ignored by the science field, that is not talked about, that shows you there's just huge problems with evolution, enough to really sink the whole theory. But I want you to know that scientists, just in case you haven't realized this, we learned this with archaeologists earlier in this series, scientists have a clear bias against any kind of special creation. Because if we are special creations of God, then obviously He exists and we have to deal with Him. But if we can prove that we came from evolutionary chance, we can ignore God and just live unto ourselves. And scientists are very clearly biased. And so what I'm going to do this morning is simply show you evidence from simply three fields that cause some serious problems with evolution. We're going to look at the field of geology, then we're going to look at the field of biology, and then we're going to look at the field of mathematics as we go through this. So let's get ready to jump right in. And the key phrase you want to remember from this message is evolution doesn't add up. And first of all, evolution doesn't add up in geology. And we're going to look at something called the geological column. Go ahead and put that up there. Okay, go ahead and put the next one up there. That is a geological column that comes right from page 419 of the Prentice Hall biology textbook, which is used in our local high schools. So this is what it is right there. This is what the geological column says in theory. It was developed as a theory in the 19th century. What it says is that animals died. Obviously, they were encased in the earth, and the least sophisticated animals are obviously deepest down in the earth. The most sophisticated animals are shallowly buried in the earth. And if you are able to dig down into the earth, you can go down almost in a line of history. And you can discover the deeper and deeper you go are evolutionary ancestors. So what they would say is the primitive animals that we originated from are on the bottom. And the more sophisticated animals, like ourselves, would be buried at the top. And you'll find the fossil record that way. Now, by the way, this is what the modern geology is built upon and how it works. It's all built upon this idea of the geological column. And there are some serious problems with the theory of the geological column. Let's go ahead and show you those. First of all, I want you to realize that the geological column is based upon circular reasoning. And it's actually based upon a double assumption. Let me explain to you what I mean by that. When you ask them what the age of the rock is in the column, what they'll say, well, we know the age of the rock based upon the animals that are found in it. That's an assumption, right? We don't know for sure. There's trilobites down there, and trilobites, they think, existed 230 million years ago. So this rock probably is from 230 million years ago. That's an assumption. It's also based on the assumption that evolution is true. That, in other words, we evolved. So you've got two assumptions, one based upon the other. It sort of circulates that way. And there's some serious problems with this because the next thing we learn is the geological column only exists in theory. This is very important to know. There is no true geological columns that have ever been unearthed or discovered on planet Earth. So this right here, not out here. For instance, you often find layers, supposedly evolutionary layers, out of order, which is a real problem because you have things that developed supposedly later actually showing up earlier and things that were supposed to be extinct millions of years earlier showing up later. That's a problem. It's not following the geological column. And you also find complete geological column evolutionary layers missing. Those are the problems we have in reality. Even the Grand Canyon, by the way, which is talked about in high school biology textbooks as one of the great evidences of the geological column, 50% of the theoretical geological column is missing from the Grand Canyon. So that, you know, I think it says it works up here, but it's not actually taking place out there. That's a problem with that. Also, this is a great one here. There are countless examples of objects from one layer mixed with objects from another layer. In other words, we have things that supposedly developed in time, but all of a sudden they're on the wrong layer. They're in the wrong order. So remember, this is occurring in theory. It's not occurring in reality. And they have a name for that, by the way. They call it stratospheric leaks. In other words, one stratosphere leaked into another stratosphere, but it didn't leak. Maybe it was just there at the same time. I'll give you an example, that one of my favorite ones of this being out of order. 1968, William Meister, he unearthed some trilobite fossils. And this, he said, oh, look at the age of this. This is at least 230 million years old because trilobites were extinct 230 million years before man showed up on planet Earth because they are our evolutionary ancestors. Remember the theory of evolution? That's what it would say. Small problem. He continued to dig right around the trilobites, and what, guess what he discovered? A sandal print. So the guy was wearing his flip-flops and stepped on the trilobite. That we know. He's going like, wait a minute, this comes 230 million years later. What do we do with that? We just ignore it. That doesn't end up in the biology textbooks. We don't want to say that because that ruins our evolutionary theory. It ruins our geological column theory. So we ignore it. And you can find it if you look in libraries, you can look in journals, but you don't find it in mainstream biology textbooks. You see what I'm saying? They have a commitment to prop up evolution as a theory. Let's go to the top of page 2 here. And this is the thing we're going to look at here. Fossilization is no longer a regularly occurring event on planet Earth. In fact, go one more up there. There's a picture going to come up. There's actually page 418 out of Prentice Hall biology textbook showing you how fossilization takes place. There's, for instance, is a fish. The fish dies. It's covered by sediment. The fish turns into the fossil. That's right out of our high school biology textbooks. But they just don't tell you that we don't have fossils all over the place. And what happens when something dies? It decays. And like even the bones decay. In fact, it doesn't. There's no mass fossilization occurring on planet Earth today. Not that there fossilization doesn't occur at all, but not in mass. In fact, one of the great examples of that was the buffalo. They used to roam the plains of the West here. Millions of buffalo. Where are all the buffalo fossils? They're not there. Because they, what happened? They decayed and went away. So what you do find from the fossil record is there was a time when massive amounts of fossilization did take place on planet Earth, but it's not occurring like that today. Well, that leaves us with a problem. What happened? Is anybody beginning to think what might have happened that would have resulted in massive fossilization on planet Earth? The flood. Exactly. Many scientists say that fossilization is evidence of a mass fossilization is evidence of a, this is the scientific term, global cataclysmic hydraulic event. That's what they say. What happens? The waters rise. You have all kinds of earth and flood moving around. And what would happen? What would be the first things that would tend to get encased in mud? The smallest animals, right? And when the bigger animals, they'd go up to higher places, wouldn't they? And you'd have more mud moving around. And but of course, it's not just the smallest animals that happen to get killed in a mud and get encased in mud. There's probably a few bigger animals that happen to succumb to it. That would be your stratospheric leaks. You see how that works? And they're encased in that layer. And ultimately, you have the rough geological column happening with a global cataclysmic hydraulic event. And I think that's a pretty good explanation for what you have with mass fossilization, where things are compressed and not allowed to decay. Interestingly, you probably read this past week about the woolly mammoth. Anybody see that? Where they're trying to now resurrect the woolly mammoth because they have literally millions of these things that are frozen in Siberia and Alaska. And in case you don't know what one of those is, it's an elephant with a big fiery coat on it. And they've been extinct, they say, for millions and billions of years. Well, we don't know that for sure. They've been extinct for a long time. And some of them were frozen so completely, and they're like flash frozen. They even still have food in their mouth when they get them out of the ice. Their DNA structure has not been crystallized. In other words, it was frozen so fast and so solid, they think they can resurrect the DNA and to bring the woolly mammoth back to life. Now, what's going on there? What some scientists believe is what happened to all these woolly mammoths was what happened when a vapor canopy collapsed All of a sudden, you went from a big blanket over planet Earth to a huge escape of heat, and you had a flash freeze on so many of these woolly mammoths. Now, I don't know if that's exactly what happened. Remember, this is speculation. I'm a preacher. I'm not a scientist. I do have technical background because that was my undergraduate, and I was always a science guy, but this is a little bit beyond me, so cut me some slack, doing the best I can. But that seems to be some good explanation of what's going on. Evidence of a global cataclysmic hydraulic event is what froze millions of woolly mammoths in the polar regions. Okay, now some of you are going to come back and say, you told me earlier that the only way we know the age of a rock is based on the animal in it, like a trilobite. And the evolutionary theory says they were extinct 230 million years ago, so the age of the rock is 230 million years old. I've heard of some other ways of dating things, and I've read about this in my textbooks, like radioactive dating. Why don't we talk about radioactive dating? Let's go ahead and do that. First of all, there are two main methods. There's the carbon-14 method of radioactive dating. There's also something called the potassium-argon method of radioactive dating for ultra, ultra old things. And this is largely responsible for what is called our current estimations of the age of planet Earth. We used to think scientifically that the Earth was a young Earth, several thousands of years old. Nowadays, they think it's between 4.5 to 5 billion years old. And the reason they believe that is because of radioactive dating. Now, let me tell you how this works. Radioactive elements degrade into a non-radioactive daughter element at a regular rate called a half-life. Am I okay with that, scientists? Did I get that right? And they say, okay, if we just take the measurement between the radioactive element, how much of that is in it, and how much of the daughter element is in it, we know what the radioactive rate of decay is, the half-life, we can put that ratio together and figure out how long this thing has been hanging around for. That's how we can get radioactively date things. They just don't tell you that there are a huge amount of assumptions with radioactive dating that can really mess things up. This is not in the books, but this is in the journals. And here's some things it says. For instance, it assumes what is being radioactively dated didn't begin with any daughter elements in the rock. In other words, it always began with pure radioactive elements and no daughter elements. But that's not reality. Why couldn't some daughter elements have been in there to begin with? And if you don't know you start from flat zero, then you are probably going to be off on your dating. Isn't that true? Second assumptions, it assumes the rate of radioactive decay is constant. We always thought for years that radioactive decay is a constant rate with a half-life. They have discovered that if things are superheated, like lava, or they're exposed to certain levels of cosmic radiation, the rate of radioactive decay can actually be altered. So what was a fixed constant is no longer considered a fixed constant by many scientists now. And that can throw your age of things off massively. Also, three, water seepage migrates both radioactive elements and daughter elements into and out of the rock. And I thought that was interesting when I learned that. So you can change the age of a rock through water seepage in it. Now, this can totally mess up what your approximate ages of an element. I'm going to give you some actual things that were radioactively dated, and I'll tell you what they came out at. Living snails came out at the age of 2,300 years old. That didn't work too well. Growing trees, radioactively dated, came out at 10,000 year old. Didn't work too well. 200-year-old lava flows that they know for sure were 200 years ago they were formed. They were dated at 3 billion years old. Why? Because the assumptions we just talked about violate your baseline in radioactive dating. Now, why do we keep using it? Well, because generally it's good, but you have to have all those assumptions working. But the other thing is that scientists love radioactive dating. You know why? Because it makes the Earth look very, very old, which sort of helps the theory they're trying to prop up, which is evolution, right? And they say if we just had enough time, we would evolve. So you see how there's a commitment to this old Earth? stuff going on right here that it's not scientifically held up. Now, I want to give you one evidence that the Earth actually is quite young rather than quite old. There's a number of these I ran across, but I thought this one would be sort of fun. This is called the meteoric dust evidence. And here's the deal. Planet Earth and many of the planets right around us, like the moon, we receive meteoric dust from interstellar space at a relatively constant rate that has been measured by NASA. By the way, I was next to NASA this week, in case you're wondering. At a relatively constant rate, it's been measured for quite some time. In fact, we receive about 14 million tons a year of meteoric dust. Now, here's the problem. If we've been receiving 14 million tons of meteoric dust for 5 billion years, that means that there would be a 182-foot layer of meteoric dust on the surface of planet Earth. And guess what? It's not there. Well, scientists have said, oh, there's an obvious reason that there's not a 182-foot layer of meteoric dust on planet Earth. It's just been mixed in with the Earth. I mean, after all, it's been around for billions of years, and so it's just mixed into our soil. Small problem with that. Meteoric dust has a super high concentration of nickel in it. In fact, if you take one of the current estimations of all the nickel that is on planet Earth and attribute it all to having come from meteoric dust, the best you can say is that planet Earth is several thousand years old, not several billion years old, because there's not enough nickel on planet Earth to account for that long of a time. It just isn't. In fact, interestingly, I put this little picture of the space capsule up here. One of the concerns they had when they landed on the moon was that if the Earth was 5 billion years old and it's been receiving all this meteoric dust, and the moon is so old as well, and it's been receiving all this dust, they thought that when the lunar capsule landed on the moon, it may sink like quicksand into a huge layer of meteoric dust and never be able to get off the ground. What do you find? They discovered the meteoric dust layer was only 1/8 of an inch thick on the moon. And that's why when you look at that picture, you can see their footprints. That's the meteoric dust layer that they are stepping in. So I thought that was pretty cool. Now, like I said, evolution just doesn't add up, does it? Now, as I've been going through this series, some people have said this has been fun, and they've had a lot. They've learned a lot. Other people have said, I'm just going to be honest, that some of this stuff is over our head. Well, the last point may be over a lot of our heads, but this point is the fun point. So this is the fun stuff. Evolution doesn't add up in biology. And I want to look at a couple of different animals out there and see if we can figure out a way that these things evolutionarily, just by chance, evolved. And the first thing I'd like to look at is our friend called the sea slug. There he comes up. By the way, I don't have any idea how this person is able to hold this sea slug unless it's a mislabeled picture I found on the internet. But let me tell you about these little guys. These guys like to eat sea anemones. Go ahead and put the next slide up. We'll show you what those sea anemones are. You guys seen these underwater? If you know much about them, they have poison cells that have little harpoons in them on those fingers. And what they do, if something touches them, those poison cells burst and plunge the poisonous harpoon into the attacker, completely poisoning it and neutralizing it. Now, sea slugs eat sea anemones. That's like their favorite thing to eat. What they do is they have some kind of way of neutralizing those poisonous cells so they do not burst. And they eat these things, and as the sea anemone goes into the sea slug's stomach, it has some kind of special way in its stomach of separating the poisonous cells off, leaving them neutralized and not burst, and the rest of the sea anemone it digests. Isn't this cool? And then it takes the poisonous cells and the ciliated hairs in it, in its stomach, it moves those poisonous cells into a special pouch it has inside of it, keeping them neutralized. The stomach is doing all this. And that's one wild digestive system. And then when the sea slug is attacked, What it does is it excretes the sea anemone's poisonous cells outside of its body and reactivates those poison cells. So the attacker gets stung by this sea anemone's poison cells that the sea slug ate. That is one wild sea creature, isn't it? Now, I want you to think about how this thing develops by evolution, just by chance. So you got a whole bunch of sea slugs checking out the sea anemones and just eating them and dying, right? By chance, somehow, one guy happens to develop a neutralizer that keeps these poisonous cells from bursting. Well, he eats a sea anemone. But somehow, by chance, he develops this like intelligent digestive system that happens to be able to strip off the poisonous cells from everything else. And then by chance, he develops a pouch and stuffs those things all in the pouch. And then by chance, he develops a completely neurological control system to reactivate those cells and then to excrete them outside of his body. Now you tell me, this all happens by chance? It's roughly the equivalent of saying, okay, I have some arsenic. We're going to mix it in the church potluck. And we're going to see how many of you can, by chance, develop a way to neutralize the arsenic, then develop a stomach that can separate the arsenic out from everything else, and then take the arsenic and put it into a little pouch in the side of your body, and you can excrete it whenever you want. What are the, like, how does that happen by chance? Because when anything you do along the way, you die if it goes wrong. This defies evolution. Let me give you another one. Have you got anybody here like is a young guy? Young guys who like things that explode? Like to blow things up? Well, this is your beetle. The Bombardier beetle is your explosive beetle. Let me tell you about him. I'll explain to you what he's doing here in a moment. Go to YouTube, by the way, kids, when you get home and look up these things. These things are awesome when they're in action. What they do is they have a pouch inside of them. And in this pouch, there are two chemicals that are highly reactive, hydroquinone and hydrogen peroxide. And when these chemicals normally come together, they violently explode. But these beetles have developed an inhibitor chemical in them. And so it takes and keeps these chemicals and an inhibitor chemical in there so it doesn't explode. But when attacked, what it does is it secretes those chemicals into a tailpipe. You can see it pulled its tailpipe down in front of it and shoots it in front. And it secretes at that point an anti-inhibitor chemical, which causes those two things to react. That comes out at 212 degrees Fahrenheit. The cool thing on YouTube, you see the smoke and the steam coming up after this thing shoots off. I mean, a big tarantula comes after one of these things on YouTube, and it just nails the tarantula, and the thing goes running away, even though it's a little tiny bug, because it napalms the tarantula right in the face. Pretty cool stuff. Now, think about how this happens to develop just by evolution. You have these bugs that happen to develop these two chemicals just by chance. But as it develops the chemicals, what does it do? Poof! It explodes on the jungle floor. So every time it develops these chemicals, it's a little firework. Until all of a sudden it develops an inhibitor chemical to keep these two chemicals from reacting. Now what is it? It's just a bug with a big pouch of nothing in it. It doesn't do anything. So then by chance, it has to develop an anti-inhibitor chemical to get it to react again. Well, it secretes its anti-inhibitor chemical into its body where it has all the other three chemicals, and it explodes. And it's done. It can't pass on any genetic mutations. Somewhere along the lines, it has to develop a tailpipe. And it has to develop a very sophisticated and perfectly timed system of mixing these chemicals together at just the right ratio and just the right time as it comes out the bottom so it can shoot stuff off, just like you see there. Because remember, if it goes wrong at any point along the way, it explodes. 212 degrees Fahrenheit when those two things mix together. Or he fries himself. Now, how does this happen just by chance? You tell me. Like I said, I'm struggling to see how evolution adds up on this one. Let's look at another one. The modern horse evolution. By the way, this is from page 228 of CBS Biology, and I want to thank our local school system for letting me go through the books. This is a common proof of evolution in most biology textbooks. They say that horses we have today are evolved. They start from little tiny guys that have multiple peds, and they eventually evolve over time into single-hoofed, full-size horses. What do we find out? The horse evolution isn't great proof of evolution. Actually, it's more like an elaborate hoax, is what one scientist said about it. I didn't even give you any fill-in-the-blanks. Let me just tell you a couple things here. First of all, no complete set of horse fossils exists in the world from this whole thing. Secondly, to follow horse fossil evolution, the smallest ones, and they call the evolutionary ancestors, start in North America. The middle ones are found over in Europe. And the other higher ones, before you get to full-size horses, are found once again back in North America. So it jumps continents, which to me seems to be a little bit of a problem. Thirdly, there are no transitional fossils between the different types of horses. We're going to talk about transitional fossils a little more in a few minutes, but you don't have like a half version of any of these horses. It's either you have one and then you have the next one. And so scientists call this punctuated equilibrium, where all of a sudden they wake up one day and a horse is having a different kind of horse for a baby. That's really what they say. No transition. Now, this one I thought was very interesting. A recent archaeological dig has unearthed fossils of full-sized modern horses existing with the fossils of the earliest horse ancestors. In other words, at one time, they all existed together and didn't evolve. Ooh, that's a nasty one. But we don't put it in the biology textbooks. Why? Because we're committed to make sure that evolution is true. Just let the facts speak. Well, it's a stratospheric layer leak. Maybe not. Okay, let's go ahead and look at some more things here. We talked about transitional fossils. I want to leverage on that a little bit because one of the great transitional fossils we're looking for is the link between ape and man. You know that one? And one of the classic ones is called Lucy. Let's go ahead and put Lucy up there. Go ahead and keep going there for a while. Okay, here she comes. Here she comes. There she is. Okay, this one particular page came off Modern Biology textbook, page 325. And she is a supposed transitional fossil. When I was growing up, I remember I was very much into the sciences. I always thought I'd be a scientist. That's why I love this stuff, as you can tell. And I like to read about it. My parents got me a subscription to a science magazine, and the magazine was called Science 80 because the year was 1980. And it was, just change the year each time. And the first issue, I'm never going to forget it, the very first issue came, and it was in a, wrapped in plastic, real fancy cover. I opened the plastic, and there it was, Science 80, Lucy, the missing link. So Lucy and I go way back. We really do. And I love this lady, but I got to tell you a little about this lady. She's not everything she's cracked up to be. And guys, you got to know that when a lady's not all she's cracked up to be. So let's talk about this. She's a supposed transitional fossil between ape and man. As you can see, as I'm showing you here, she's only 40% complete. So we don't have a full body structure on this lady. She was found in Ethiopia in 1974. And I want to quote for you from National Geographic about her. It was said in this day. It says, "The angle of her thigh bone and the flattened surface of her knee proved she walked on two legs. Thus, that makes her a transitional fossil between ape and man." Now, I'm just going to ask you to be a little scientist. Look at her thigh bone and look at her knee. How much of it do you get? There's not much there, is there? I mean, we often just trust the scientists if they say something right up front. And like, let's look at her. There's not much thigh and there's not much knee. Now, let me tell you what has come about Lucy in recent years. First of all, the archaeologist sort of slipped and eventually told where they found her knee joint and that little bottom bone. It came from a stratospheric layer that was actually 200 feet deeper than the rest of her skeleton and over 2 miles away. They just happened to let that out by a mistake, and all of a sudden, people began to get really upset. And Donald Johnson, who was the head of the archaeological team, became the butt of many jokes in scientific communities. In fact, Lucy is now considered a work of imagination, not a work of science. But I have to tell you, guess what? She's in just about every single one of the high school biology textbooks I checked this past week. Why? Because we have a commitment to evolution, to proving it's true. That's what's there. I'm just being honest. You've got to realize this. It's bias. But scientifically, she does not stand up any longer. Okay, let me give you a couple things as we close this section here, what I call my favorite questions that evolutionists can't answer. High school kids, write this down. You're going to have fun in class with these guys. This is what you do. First of all, you say, how did something come from nothing? You say, teacher, where did we come from? They say, well, we're descendants of the apes. Oh, well, where did the apes come from? Well, they're descendants of a lower animal form. Well, where did they come from? Well, they eventually, maybe it came from a fish, the fish that went onto the land. Well, where did the fish come from? Well, that's descendants way back down of bacteria. Well, where did the bacteria come from? Well, it was just on planet Earth. Well, where did planet Earth come from? Well, in the solar system. Where did the solar system come from? A Big Bang. Well, where did the Big Bang come from? I don't know. So you're telling me something came from nothing one day? There's no answer. Somebody had to create something. Secondly, what bridged the gap between matter and life? That's an incredibly difficult gap to bridge. There's a big difference between a rock and something that's living. What creates life? There's no answer there. You know, they'll say bacteria or certain viruses and things like that. They're like living, but they're non-living. They inject DNA. There's just all kinds of questions there. And the third question goes back to what we talked about with Lucy. Where are the transitional fossils? There is a real lack of transitional fossils out there. And so what they have done is they don't see now a consistent rate of evolution, but they talk about punctuated equilibrium where all of a sudden one day, you know, like the horse wakes up and it's having given birth to a different kind of horse. Why? Because there's no transitional fossil there. And there's a desperate search for them. That's why Lucy is still in the textbooks, because we're hoping we can find something that transitions between ape and man. And we just don't have it. Okay. Last piece here. I want to keep moving on this, but I want to let you have this last one because I want to make sure we get to our Faith University classes. For those of you who thought that there are things in this series that are hard to follow, this is hard to follow. I'm a little rusty on my math, and you guys who are mathematically inclined can come and correct me afterwards. I'm pulling this out of a book I read 12 years ago, but to me, I love this because this is completely devastating to evolution. I've never seen this anyplace else besides one of the books I read. Evolution doesn't add up in mathematics. It doesn't. We're using some probability and statistics here. What we are told is you take a monkey and you put him at a typewriter and he just randomly types on the typewriter for a long enough period of time, eventually he would type out a completely unabridged dictionary. Error-free. Anybody heard that? That's the example of how evolution works. Except let's do the math on that. What's just the statistical probability of a monkey just randomly typing one single word? The word evolution. Just 9 characters in the right order. On a 26, let's just say there's only 26 characters you can type. Let's leave all the function keys and control keys off the keyboard for a moment, for just argument's sake. Well, what are the chances of randomly typing the word evolution? 1 in 26 to the 9th power. And you see how that would work? 26 possible characters, 9th power, which happens to be 1 in, let's see if I get this right here, 5,429,503,679,000 chance of doing that. Did you realize the odds are that highly stacked against only 9 letters in the right order? Let's just take it up a notch. What are the chances of shuffling cards, just get up playing cards, take them, put the numbers 1 through 20 on 20 cards, shuffle them. What are the chances of laying down those cards in the proper numerical order, 1 through 20. Mathematically, that is called a 1 in 20 factorial chance. Factorial means you take 20 by 19 by 18 by 17 by 16, work it all the way down to 1. Okay, that's the chances of being able to do that, which happens to be 1 in, go ahead and put that up there. I just did a 20 factorial thing. Go ahead and put that up there. Okay, just, alrighty. Okay, I don't know if I have it up there. I can't even read it. Does anybody know what number that is, like a sextillion or something? It's in your outline. I can't pronounce anything over a billion, a trillion, and what else comes after that? Quadrillion? Quintillion? So it's like a 1 in 2 quintillion chance of getting those 20 cards in order right? I mean, seriously, just do the math. It's right there. Okay, so it's not likely it's going to happen. So I wouldn't put, I mean, you got a better chance of getting hit by lightning. That's a 1 in 600,000 chance. So go outside and play in the rain. Let's try this again. Let's take it up a notch. Instead of 20 cards, let's do 200 cards. What's the chance of having 200 cards numbered 1 through 200, shuffling them and laying them down in proper order? Well, I'm just going to do it this way. It's just 1 in 10 to the 375th power. That's a 1 with 375 zeros after it. I don't know how big that is. Don't tell me a quintillion or anything. I don't think anybody knows how big that is. It's like incredibly impossible. Well, evolutionists say, well, that's okay. I understand. We just need a lot of matter and a lot of time, and things can happen. We can evolve. Really? Let's try and put some parameters around this. Let's take one of the rough estimate of all the number of electrons that exist in the entire universe. So grouping all the electrons in the universe into groups of 200 right now would only give you 5 times 10 to the 77th power possible combinations. To get a 200-order set in the proper order, you need a 1 times 10 to the 375th power. You understand what I'm saying? There's just not enough matter in electrons, that's as small as you can go, on planet Earth, to randomly order them all into, and take all the electrons, put them into groups of 200, number of 1 through 200, and make them random. You're not going to have enough electrons in the entire universe to get a 1 to 200 ordered set. No evolutionists say, well, I understand. We talked about a lot of matter, but you need time. We're based on time. Remember, we have an old Earth, 4.5 to 5 billion years of time. Okay, I'll add time. Why don't we take those sets of 200 electrons, you know, over the entire planet? Let's regroup them at the rate of 1 billion recombinations per second and keep doing it for 30 billion years. You think that helps a little bit? Not really, because that only gives you 10 to the 24th power more possible recombinations. Not that much. So now you have, that gives you 10 or 5 times 10 to the 104th power possibilities. Way short of 10 to the 375th power possible recombinations necessary. So my point is, even if you took the longest amount of time you wanted, even if you took all the electrons in the universe, you do not have enough of a chance to get a 200-order set just randomly taken place, like, ever. Does that make sense? Did I lose everybody on that? Okay. Now, this is where we connect it right back into biology. The most basic amino acid is a 400-piece ordered set. We've only been working with 200-piece ordered sets. The chance occurrence of the proper ordering of the components of self-replicating DNA is 1 in 10 to the 167,626 power. So what's the chance occurrence of self-replicating DNA happening just by chance on planet Earth, given the oldest age possible that anybody could ever conceive of? Like, zero. Mathematically, it's impossible. Now, interestingly, mathematicians currently consider anything beyond a 1 in 10 to the 50th power to be statistically impossible. And DNA is 1 in 10 to the 167,626 power. Like I said, evolution doesn't
add up, does it? So you have two options. Either we're special creations of God, or we happen by chance. And happening by chance doesn't add up. But they don't want to tell you that. So which one are you going to choose? To trust in the words of this book, or trust in the words of science? Next week, I'm just going to go ahead and close here, but next week we're going to look at providential reasons to believe this book. We've talked about the Da Vinci Code. You know, the Da Vinci Code says that this book is missing a bunch of books. We're going to discover next week how we actually ended up with the books that are in our Bible and why we can trust them as being the words of God given to us. Let me pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for this congregation's patience as we went through some interesting but often detailed material. I pray especially for our teenagers who are assaulted by evolution, Lord, and told, like the beginning of this article, they're told that if they don't believe in evolution, that they are just living in a fantasy world, and that all of Darwin's postulates have been proven, and evolution is not a theory, but it's a fact, and they just don't know the facts. And so I pray that what we're able to share today would bolster them in their belief in the Word of God, that they are special creations of God's hand. They are not chance creations of a random, purposeless, pointless evolutionary world. Thank you for your word, and thank you for science that we can use to actually prove and support the world's basis.